Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, wherever you are. I hope you are having a magnificent day or evening on this planet. Relationships. Oh, my goodness. They present so many challenges to us in so many different ways. And we're going to be focusing this evening on understanding the relationships between mothers and their daughters. Now, often things are romanticized in life, but frequently relationships between mothers and daughters can be very, very unpleasant, and also they can be absolutely wonderful. And of course, there's anything and everything between the two extremes. My guest, Kara Crosthwaite Brindle, is a woman who has been for 13 years very much engaged in working with women and helping them to resolve a lot of their issues. And she's put out her book, Understanding Ruptured Mother-Daughter Relationships. And the subtitle of the book is Guiding the Adult Daughter's Healing Journey Through the Estrangement Energy Cycle. I want to welcome Kara Brindle to the show. Welcome, Kara. And you've got a very unique profession here.
Thank you, Donna. I'm happy to be here. Thanks so much.
It is a pleasure to have you. Kara, when you decided to get into therapy, what was it that enabled you to make a choice about primarily working with women, and especially with those relationships between mothers and daughters? How is it that you evolved into that?
You know, I think there's a lot of women who are coming to therapy. So I think, you know, the majority of my clients over the years have been women. And even though they came in with a variety of different things they wanted to work on, I started to see a pattern with the relationship with mom. So that kind of catapulted me into some curiosity and eventually writing a blog on this topic and then writing a book when I realized it wasn't just me. Mm-hmm. What's going on.
Estrangement energy. You use these two words in your publication. What do they mean? And why did you say estrangement energy?
I appreciate that, Donna. So some people, it's the energy of anticipating an estrangement. So some of these women were thinking it through, laying it out, wondering what would happen. So it took a lot of mental energy for them to even consider estrangement. And then other folks I was working with, women, were actually in the estrangement. So that was taking energy from them in a different way, most often grief and loss. So for some women, it's the thought and contemplation. For others, it's the action and the lived experience of estrangement.
In your introduction, you have made a comment that I thought was a very honest comment. You married into a family that had multiple estrangements, and that actually has a great deal to do with your having produced this book. What kind of estrangements were going on, if you don't mind my asking you a personal question?
Yeah, not a problem. So actually, a lot of the estrangements have happened in the last 7 years, and so it's pretty fresh in the family. But we've had estrangement patterns in that family since, you know, grandparents' generation to now. So we actually have 4 generations of estrangement that aren't speaking to each other. And so it makes holidays and family functions a little awkward, if I'm being honest, which obviously I wanted to talk about in this book and normalize what we can do with that information. But yeah, 4 generations, pretty wild.
Well, I think that is not uncommon, believe it or not. It's just, and I'm sure you believe it because you deal with it every day. But this idea that is so often promoted by various programs, various television shows, movies, that there should be this absolutely perfect association with people, sometimes just because somebody is a blood relative doesn't mean that they're necessarily a nice person. I don't care what member of the family hierarchy they are in. But it is interesting to me that when you started your book, and you've got a section defining estrangement, you talk about a woman, Sherry McGregor, who authored a book, and she reported in her book that 9,000 parents had taken her survey on estrangement from their adult children, and it appeared that a substantial amount of them were mothers.
Yeah, I think that's still an ongoing piece that's accurate. I know that since this book has come out, other research has come out about reconciliation and percentages around that, which is giving people a lot more hope on that subject. But yeah, 1 in 12 people is reporting they're estranged from at least one family member. So we can imagine that includes mothers.
You give warning signs for daughters and warning signs for mothers. And this is sometimes such a huge challenge. I know it occurred in my family. And this is something that, just like your family, if you're going back for four generations, this was something in my family, to the best of my knowledge, that went back that far as well, if not further. And it's very interesting how that carries forward in generational patternings. This is something that in your research, what have you found out about the generational patternings, the genetic patternings, if you will, that often have that continuum of process of agitation and separation? What have you discovered relative to that?
I think there's a couple different things popping in my mind, Donna, one of which is there's generational trauma. Right, so we have learned behaviors and patterns that are passed down from one generation to the next. I think estrangement can be modeled. I think we can actually have it seen as normalized. So this is how we handle conflict, which is speaking to my family that I married into. It's been normed. This is what we do when we're hurt and it's not getting better. We just stop talking. So there's, I think, trauma lens for this. There's modeling for this. There's, hey, this is just how we handle things. I think there's a lot to that. There's that nature versus nurture component that people could really relate to.
We all have various experiences that we go through. And dependent on our personalities and our predispositions that we come in with, and then what we develop with our family associations, our schools, our teachers, social associations, all of this plays into it. And you do have a section in your book relative to culture. What, in your opinion, how much strength does the cultural environment, not just of the family, but of a society within a family, affect these estrangements?
You know, I think it really speaks to, is it normed and appropriate to estrange, or do we have messages that family comes first? That we're supposed to be this perfect family, as you alluded to earlier. So I mean that there are certain cultures that are very much about family comes first. We put our family in front of ourselves. So I think our Eastern cultures in that way versus Western cultures focus on independence and separating from mom and dad. So I think culture plays a part. What I think of, like, Italian families, Hispanic families, where family is very, very important. And so to think of estrangement at all is not normal for them. And yet we have leaders talking about it and trying to normalize it now, that not everyone can stay connected to their family.
You bring out some points also that I think are significant. You say symptoms of estrangement, sadness, anger, shock, helplessness, there's shame, guilt, loss of identity, blame, failure, social avoidance. There's so much that you bring out in this book. And maybe when you're listening to these stories, you have to also get the other side of the story, which sometimes is pretty hard to do, especially when you're dealing with an estrangement. And it can be on both sides of the aisle, so to speak. And this is really a huge challenge, isn't it?
It really is, especially because I think what you and I can agree is that people are coming in and doing this work individually with mental health professionals, but it's actually more rare for families to come together and do this work, which as a mental health professional, I think that would be very healing for reconciliation to be possible. But it was more often than not that adult daughter was coming in to do her own work because mom didn't want to or wasn't ready. And so having individual therapy, you're absolutely right, only has one side. We never get to interact with mom or dad or whoever they're estranged from.
It's really quite a challenge. So when you're dealing with the daughters, let's say, and they're singularly trying to come into their own and really rectify their own, you might say, discord, even without the mother, that is quite a challenge because then they have to acknowledge their own personal responsibility for creating their own environment of stability and happiness, do they not?
Absolutely. So looking at like some identity transformation, some harder looks at self-worth with or without mom, there's a lot to the cycle that way. I think there's plenty here to unpack, but there's 24 tools in the book itself where women can say, I can pick up this book, I can do this with a therapist, I can do this with a coach, I can do this on my own. But so many of those women had to come to terms with, what if this never happens? What if mom never apologizes? I mean, that's our fantasy, right? Is we want mom to apologize. We want her to acknowledge what's happened so that we can heal together, so we can come together. But if that's not going to happen, you're absolutely right. Adult daughter would have to do this work on her own and take some of that accountability, but also empowerment to say, if this never happens, here's what I can do.
You bring up one, you have many different examples in your book and different people you speak to. I found the section on partners very important because estrangement can have a big effect on a partner that may or may not have any understanding of what that individual is going through. And you had two women. One was Keisha, and the other one was Tony. And there were many similarities, but also differences between these two women. What did they have to find out relative to their interaction with their mother?
What shows up for me as you ask this is partners that they have no lived experience with estrangement tend to fall into the traps of community members, which is just talk to them, just reconcile, be the bigger person, start talking to your mother again. And that's not going to bode well for the relationship as an intimate partner because adult daughter won't feel seen. So I think for both Keisha and Tony, one of them, obviously Tony had to, your listeners haven't read the book yet, but Tony's able to set some boundaries with grandparents and mom and have some different things going on. Whereas Keisha didn't feel seen by her partner at all, even though she had physical abuse from her mother. So I think this really speaks to there are things that can be healed and we can come back from, and then there are things that make it really hard to reconcile, which includes trauma, abuse, and neglect.
Mm-hmm. Very true. And it is that sometimes there are those situations where they're not going to reconcile. It's just not going to happen. And it could be
Exactly. It's
the mother that is the mother from hell, excuse me, but there are those women that are that way. And then you have the daughters from hell. I mean, it's just, the variables are just amazing. But if there is that common ground, which maybe through therapy, there can be that positioning and understanding, that can be very, very healing. And that is something that sometimes, because of therapy, then there is that opportunity to be able to look at things with a different eye, if you will. And then maybe there can be a reconciliation. But it really is something that we need to come to terms with ourselves. And whatever that situation might be for ourselves. And it really is quite amazing at all of the variables. You talk about a woman, Regina, and oh my goodness, what she had to go through and the community that she was a part of. Wow, she really went through quite a bit of negativity on so many different levels.
She sure did. Yeah, she stands out in my mind even now. Obviously, a lot of the women in the book are compilations of true clients with identify underlying factors changed. But her experience, I think, is something we hear from a lot of adult daughters, which is start talking to mom, just get over it, handle it, be the bigger person. Our community included a religious component. And I think when we have communities that are a part of our life that way, saying be the bigger person, it really leads to a lot of internal confliction of, am I missing something? Have I tried everything I could? How do I heal? How do I help mom and I come back together? And so Regina had a hard time hearing that and then questioning her own worth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then there are sometimes those individuals that will have, I like to call it a holier-than-thou attitude, and they don't do much to really have the clear understanding or even are willing to listen to what someone is expressing. And in her case, she really got some commentaries from different people that she had to learn. They didn't have any real scope of reality relative to her condition.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, like to just discount her sexual abuse. There was so much there for her to be estranged from multiple family members, not just mom, but others as well, because they said really hurtful things of, that didn't happen to you. You're making that up. You're lying. I mean, can you imagine standing in front of your loved ones and being told that you're not telling the truth? Of course she had to make the choice to estrange. She was trying to protect herself.
Mm-hmm. Very, very true. The mother-daughter bond, that can be strong, and it can be also non-existent. With those that come to you, what is the significance of that mother-daughter bond? And what is it that you find that in so many that come to seek your counsel? And, of course, I know you relate a number of stories in your book, Understanding Ruptured Mother-Daughter Relationships. But that is something that I think we should chat about, because not everyone has that bond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is really thinking about attachment, right? Attachment styles have become more talked about, I think, in different circles. And so I talk about attachment from infancy, what that looks like to have secure attachment versus anxious or avoidant attachment, how that translates to adult relationships, including with mom. And so for some of these women, if mom was emotionally absent, there was no attachment. If mom was physically absent, there was no attachment. And so that would contribute to, I think, a higher likelihood of estrangement if she didn't feel attached to mom to begin with.
You bring up the cycle of abuse. Now, there is that movie that was done on Sybil, who had multiple personalities. There have been many different commentaries, but often it's not brought out very, very strongly. And in your book, you wanted to address this. Why is this so important to really be attentive to?
Yeah, trauma is something that takes such a long time to heal from. And obviously being a therapist, a lot of the work that I do, even without recruiting it, is trauma work, whether that's relational trauma or physical trauma or war, things like that. So I think even just being able to name that as a reason for why people estrange, I was trying to normalize that and help adult daughters feel seen. So I've talked to colleagues about this book feels like a love letter to adult daughters saying, I see you, I hear you, I want to help you, I want to help clinicians help you. So there's not a lot of books out there for adult daughter. There were way more books for the parents, which was kind of surprising to discover.
When you're working with these women, what is one of the first things that you want them to be able to be assured of?
I want them to be assured this is a safe space to talk about it, that there's no judgment, I have no agenda for them. Even in the book, I make it clear that I'm not championing estrangement. I just want people to know it's possible and why it happens. And there'll be plenty of people who reconcile with their mother. We don't have data on how they reconciled or why they reconciled. So my curiosity is piqued. How did that happen? How long did it take? But for so many people, when they come into therapy, they just want to feel like it's a safe space without judgment. Especially if the community has a lot of opinions about estrangement, a lot of bias about estrangement. So coming in saying, I have no agenda other than to help you and support you and be neutral for you, I think is very freeing for them.
One of the women that you speak of in your book, and of course there's quite a bit that we're not even going to be able to touch. You cover many different aspects of estrangement in your book. You make a point of saying, watch for warning signs. What are some of those warning signs, and why is it you want people, women especially, to be aware of them?
Yeah, so that's kind of circling back to warning signs for mothers, warning signs for daughters. Warning signs are really about boundaries of, like, do we have boundary violations happening? Do we have an absence of boundaries? Is there codependency? Is there abuse? Is there neglect? So just kind of checking out. That's where I kind of created this lighthearted quiz in the book of, here's something to think about. Mom, are you doing any of these things? Daughter, are you doing any of these things? It's not diagnostic by any means, but I think it's a way to check out how healthy is this relationship? What could be improved? What could be changed? And so at that level, I think warning signs can be unique to each person, but I was seeing patterns in an absence of boundaries and things of that nature that just made it feel more able to be packaged as a quiz and say, how's this going? What needs to improve?
Mm-hmm. Why did you incorporate EMDR into part of your therapeutic assistance for people?
Yeah, so EMDR is a very popular trauma therapy right now. And so for some of these women, they'd heard about it, they were curious about it, they knew I was a trained practitioner, but they were curious if that would help them in their relationship with mom or any other trauma they've had. More often than not, women have multiple traumas. It's not just specific to mom. Obviously, that's the audience I'm talking to. But maybe they had trauma like a car accident or a different relational trauma. So a lot of these women came in with curiosity of, hey, I've tried all these other things. What can I try next? Let's try this.
Mm-hmm. How effective has that been for the people that you have been able to use it with?
It's been pretty powerful. I mean, it's not uncommon for there to be a lot of tears, a lot of somatic or body experiences. I think it's well done for people who don't want to verbalize the pain, but they experience the pain. So you don't have to talk through it. It's not talk therapy by any means. But they can focus on a traumatic event, notice that in their body, and do this work and feel like it's lighter, it's less charged. We're not about taking it away. It's definitely part of what shaped them to be who they are today. But to take away the charge of I'm reliving it, that's very empowering.
When I saw that one of the exercises that you use is what you call the self-portrait exercise, and I think that that is an expression of art therapy to a degree, which I think is extraordinarily powerful too, and that is something that I would love for you to share with my listeners, because I think the self-portrait exercise is just absolutely wonderful, and it really can give you an insight into what a person is feeling. Do you hand them a box of crayons, colored pencils? How do you do this exercise?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the clients I serve now are telehealth, so it gives them a little bit more choice in the matter of what do you have handy, do you want to do this as homework? But I think there is something to be said of pick the medium that speaks to you. So some people just want to use a pen. Other people want to get really into it with crayons. One client recently did a collage, which was pretty cool. But yeah, just like finding a way to do a deeper dive into the internal expression, how people see you on the outside. I mean, there's lots of variations to this. But I love that you tied it to art therapy, because a professional in my network just said, art is like a third therapist in the room. Like, it's a third person in a way to help with healing. And I love that like they help, the art helps pull the work along, helps with like a trajectory of healing. And I liked how that sounded. And I'm not an art therapist.
Well, I don't think you have to be an art therapist. I think I can remember when my daughter was very, very small, and I've seen this with children and people of all ages, that she was making drawings and I knew something was disturbing her. Because of the colors that she chose. She was using, you know, she had all those multiple crayons that she could use. And often you can get people because they go into that altered state when they're drawing. And the colors they choose, they don't realize how those speak to the energy of what they're putting on paper. And it really is fascinating. And I know once a certain situation was resolved with my daughter, I watched her drawings that she was doing, and it was like a 180-degree shift. So it is something that allows you, I feel, to really get an inside line to the way people work. So I agree with your friend. You talk about power poses. Now, if somebody is in a drama class, they're in an acting class of any kind, they learn about all of these stances. But when you go out in the public today and you observe people, I think it's great to just sit in a comfortable chair like at the mall and just watch people. Or if you're at some event where there's a whole bunch of people, look at them and look at how they walk. It's amazing to me. And it's not just because of the phones that are in their hands with their heads down, but even if they don't have that, their posture, their shoulders are rounded. It's like they are just feeling depressed. They don't have the presence of having their head up, their shoulders back, and walking with an open, even stride. And when they're talking with somebody, they might mumble. All of these body signs really give a lot of insight about a person, do they not?
Absolutely. You're making me think of a study where someone had been through trauma and they were really curled over, kind of like the fetal position, standing up. Their head was down, their shoulders were rolled forward. It was very powerful to see how their posture changed with some of that trauma therapy. But even the study of someone holding a pencil between their teeth, which kind of mimics the muscles of smiling, and how that reported a change in mood. I think all of these things are connected. If we walk a certain way, do we feel differently? Do we feel more powerful? Do we feel confident? Versus if we walk curled over, do we feel depressed? Do we feel more like a victim? That doesn't feel great.
Mm-hmm. It really is fascinating. You have some illustrations in your book. You talk about the estrangement energy cycle, and it goes into a circle, and it will often, that estrangement will often be accepted by an individual as a definition of who they are, that gee whiz, because this is going on, I don't have any self-worth. And that's the challenge, not to get stuck in the I don't have self-worth imaging, and to realize that you can have self-worth, and that's okay. You don't have to have the approval, for example, of mom. But depending on what the situation is, you can be your own person, and you can have a very healthy life. You can have a very rich life. And maybe it means you just accept the person as they are, and if they're not that nice person, then you just say, thank you very much, but you're toxic, and I'm not going to have you in my space. And that happens in life. That happens. There are those relationships that are so toxic, and it can go both ways. A mother not wanting anything to do with her daughter because of that toxicity, and the daughter not wanting anything to do with the mother because of toxicity. And this is something that I think it's a challenge for just about anybody to go through. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's really about wanting to protect our mental and physical well-being. So if we look at it from that lens, a lot of our choices can come with compassion of, oh, you wanted to protect yourself. Of course you needed to exit that relationship. Oh, you wanted to make sure you weren't harmed further. Of course you needed to estrange. It's not usually impulsive, which I talk a lot about in the book, but this is my need to change something, to not keep going in this pattern of abuse or hurt or neglect. And so they're like, I have to make a choice. I can't sustain this. And so the first four stages of that cycle is just the questioning of what do I do to get to estrangement before I hit grief and loss, and then that self-worth that you're talking about. So it's kind of the upswing of the cycle.
Mm-hmm. I know of I'm thinking of a particular individual who had been estranged from her mother for a number of years. And when she married, her spouse could not understand what her feelings were. And there came an opportunity where she was able to interact, and her husband was with her when she reconnected with the estranged mother. And there was so much hate that was projected out. And he saw it, and he saw the dynamics of what went on, and he acknowledged to his wife, he said, "I didn't believe you, but I've seen it with my own eyes." And he never, ever questioned her about that again, ever. And it was just, it's fascinating how different people have different aspects of situations. And there can be some reconciliation. Sometimes it's not possible. Other times it's very possible. And I agree with what we discussed earlier, that it's nice if the whole family can come in. But that often is not the case. And so seeking out therapy can really be good. And in your book, you have a comment by Agelius, and this was an individual that gave some research on estrangement in 2016. She said, "Men and women respond differently to how they move towards acceptance of estrangement. Women tend to be more emotive in order to grieve and process the loss association with estrangement, whereas men are more likely to respond with problem solving and intellectualizing what happened in order to help them move on from an estranged relationship." This is just a very interesting point, and I would like your feedback on that. How do you feel about that commentary?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason I wanted to include that is it felt very accurate to the interviews that I completed for my book. I talked to mostly women. I talked to a few men. I think when we think back to like mother-daughter relationship or mother-son, there's an expectation, a natural expectation that son will become independent, move on, have his own family. So even the estrangement between mother and son looks different. But I think for women, we're seen as an extension of our mother. So we have this healthy attachment, maybe we have unhealthy attachment, but we're seen as part of her. And in its worst form, if we let her down, then we're bad. So I think although men are estranging, I think there's more pressure for women to reconcile with their mothers versus sons. So we say, yep, that makes sense. You're going on with your life.
Well, those are some perspectives that we've been able to share with my audience. Understanding Ruptured Mother-Daughter Relationships, Guiding the Adult Daughter's Healing Journey Through the Estrangement Energy Cycle. And that's your website, estrangementenergycycle.com. Estrangementenergycycle.com. Kara Brendel, you obviously are very well suited and really like your work and find a great deal of satisfaction in it. I wish you continued success and thank you for being my guest.
Thank you so much, Donna.
It has been my pleasure. We're saying goodbye to Kara Brendel and go check out her website. You can check out estrangementenergycycle.com. We are taking a break. We are going to be back in just a moment. I am in studio, and if you'd like to give me a call, 253-582-5597. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio, able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to Mrs. Sebo's Classics. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on the Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to the Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's the Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. 253-582-5597 is the number to call into if you'd like to chat with me this evening. Well, the newsletter went out. Yes, it went out on the 1st, but it didn't go out early on the 1st. It went out a little bit late because of my crazy schedule. But I've had so many fun comments from people because there is a story about the Pillsbury Doughboy that is featured in the newsletter that apparently people are really enjoying. So I want you to know that that is going to be up on my website. One of the things that happens when the newsletter goes out, it always goes out to my webmaster, and I haven't checked the website, and if he's not able to get it up, we have been having some problems with communication, and the provider for the internet that he has, which is a major provider, they have had all kinds of problems, and I don't know if you heard the warning that was put out about the magnetic storms that are affecting us this month of April by the sun. They are just coming out full force, and they said that it was going to be affecting us through the month of April, and actually those magnetic storms could have a pretty heavy impact, depending on where you are, I guess, towards the latter part of the month. So maybe some weird things are going on with your computer system. I know that it's been going on with my webmaster, which has surprised me because I've never had a problem reaching him. So I've got to check in with him tomorrow to make sure that he's gotten everything the way he should. But anyway, I wanted you to know that our television program, our next television program, is going to be filmed this coming Thursday. I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be on Mind Power for Everyday Life. Now, I will be sure to let you know when it is being aired and when we have it up on YouTube as well as my website. Also, we have the Authors Showcase, and we are going to be, as time allows, my schedule has been so intense it hasn't worked out that way, but as time allows, we are going to be putting out that information relative to some of the talks that I've had on the psychic spectrum. That is also going to be put up in the video format, so we'll be letting you know when I'm able to get that done too. Boy, oh boy, things just seem to be moving along at such a pace. You hear me say that frequently, and I talk to so many independent people that say the same thing. They go, my goodness, can you believe it? It's already a quarter of the year has passed. We're past the bunny rabbit. Now we're going, you know, towards the various events that are going to be coming about with spring being in full force. And then summer comes here and there we go. My goodness. That's one thing about being busy. You find that the days just seem to go by so very quickly. Also, the information about my appearances will be in the newsletter and all of my guest listings. There's a few spaces that we are waiting for confirmation from authors on, and then you'll find that information that is up on my website on the network page as well. As I am able to get everything confirmed, yes, I have to confirm things with my authors, then you will be made aware of that. Well, I wanted to touch on a couple of things. My, I am consistently amazed at the research that is being brought forth about an area that so many people have an interest in, and you probably do too, and that is Egypt. And the research that I recently became aware of actually was discovered quite a while ago. So I will be sharing some of that with you in coming programs and maybe a little bit this evening. But I wanted to talk first about an epidemic. Now, we've been through a pandemic with the COVID virus. Well, there was a woman in the Midwest. She was from Philadelphia. She was a trained healer. This epidemic started, and it was called a milk sickness. Now, this occurred in the early 1800s. And at that time, people were moving across the country to be able maybe to have a farm. They were exploring the unknown, the frontier, if you will. Well, in the early 1800s, people were moving with their herds. They were taking their animals along with them, which is very normal. We even do that today. Maybe we don't have a herd of cows, but we've got dogs, cats, You know, ferrets, we've got parrots, we've got all kinds of critters that we take with us whenever we move. Well, a very healthy person within a very short period of time would become very ill. They would be vomiting. They would then go into a coma and would die. There was a doctor by the name of Daniel Drake. He was in Cincinnati, Ohio. And he said, you know, this is really very baffling. I don't understand what is happening here. And he couldn't figure out what was going on. Well, as it turned out, from 1809 to 1927, this very unknown strange disease killed thousands of settlers and farmers in the Midwest, including Abraham Lincoln's mother. And at that time, they didn't have any idea what was going on. But there was a young midwife who was able to figure out what was happening, and what she did was observe what was going on around her. And she said milk sickness, that was what it was described as, was seasonal. Now think about this. There was nothing in the way of technology like we have today. Nobody was doing blood work on anybody. This was just her observation. And she said, there is something in the environment that is creating this. Now, she was born in the early 1800s, and her family settled in southern Illinois in an area called Rock Creek, and it was about 100 miles east of the Mississippi River. And it was frontier country, no question about that. Well, when she was a teenager, and in her era, a teenager was considered a woman, not a teenager. That word didn't come around until the 30s, 1930s. So here she is in the 1800s. She was very much interested in how she could help other people. And there was an account written about her by a doctor. He was a physician in Alabama. His name was William Snively. And there was also Luana Furby of the American Dental Association that wrote about Anna, because she was quite incredible with her observational skills. Now, she did go to Philadelphia to study nursing, and she also wanted to know about midwifery, and she was also trained in dentistry. And when historians tried to find out more about Anna, they said, we just don't have that much written history about her. But she ended up going back home. She ended up going back to Rock Creek. And she would take care of midwifing for mothers and dealt with cholera and all kinds of diseases. She was married. Well, once the milk sickness hit, her family was affected quite deeply. Her mother and her sister-in-law died from it. And she said her father was also seriously affected by it. And he went to Philadelphia to get some treatment. And she said, this is something I'm noticing, that it's occurring in the seasons. I wonder why that is the case. Now, this is what she observed. She figured out that plants, rather than water or metals, were the source of the poison. And she said, I am telling everyone I can to abstain wholly from milk and butter until after the frosts kills off the plants. Now, she kept a journal, and this is how they know about what she did. Now, in 1834, it was fall, she decided she was going to do some exploring. She went out, and like all women in the frontier, she carried a rifle with her. She packed up some food, and she took her dogs with her. And they began tracking the cattle in the local area because they were free roaming, and observed what they were eating. And she said she, in that journey, when she was out in the forest, she came in contact with a very old Shawnee woman. This woman was hiding in the forest because she wanted to evade the forced migration of her people to Kansas. Well, Anna made friends with this woman right away. She said, let me give you some food. And she said, you come home with me. Well, when the woman found out about Anna's interest in the milk sickness, she told her, she said, I know exactly what plant you're looking for. Well, of course, Anna must have just been stunned. So the woman, after resting and having some food, she took Anna out to a ridge in a nearby area, and she said, see this plant. And this was a nondescriptive type of plant. It had disc-shaped leaves, there was a very firm stem, and it had bundles of small, fuzzy white flowers. And she said, this is the forest plant that is making the cows sick and poisoning their milk. It's called white snake root, and it's a small perennial herb native to the eastern half of the United States. Well, Anna decided to do some experiments. She experimented by feeding this white snake root to animals, including calves, and she observed the animals. She found that the animals had the trembling, just like people did, of milk sickness. What did she do? She started telling people about this plant. And according to the article that was written by the physician and the dentist, Snively and Furbies, in 1966, an article that about Anna and her discovery, it saved lives. In fact, the men in the county started looking through the forests and fields, destroying the plant. She also established a garden of white snake root in a yard so that the locals would know how to identify it. She even went so far as to writing letters telling physicians to examine the plant. But who knows if any of them even responded to her, because typically the attitude was, if it came from a woman, a midwife, she doesn't know what she's talking about. However, do you know, after 3 years, because of Anna's education of the people, that plant was nearly totally destroyed in southeastern Illinois. Now, that should have been the end of this horrible illness. Well, it was in her county. But it didn't spread. The word didn't go out very far. Remember, there's very few doctors at that time. There were very few ways of communicating except by letter. And they were just going to trust a frontier midwife. That's what she was considered. And just like I said, there was a man by the name of John Holler, who is an emeritus professor of history at Southern Illinois University. And he said he has enjoyed writing about American medicine. And he said any woman that gave any information was automatically, it was just tossed out because women couldn't possibly figure things out. Well, in 1862, now think about this, 1862, 30 years after she found out this information, tried to get it out to as many people as possible, it still was a disease that was endemic among many, many people in Indiana and Illinois. And as late as 1885, a North Carolina doctor said that he thought the illness was caused by arsenic poisoning through cow's milk. But by golly, they said milk sickness was rarely ever mentioned, even in 19th century American medical textbooks. Why? Because the textbooks ignored anything that had to do with frontier medicine. Well, by 1900, it was becoming less common, but that was because of the industrialization of agriculture and safer methods of feeding cows and processing milk. Researchers did not find out what she learned in the 1800s. It wasn't until 1927 that people within the U.S. Department of Agriculture published a chemical analysis on toxic substances in white snake root. It took that long for it finally to be discovered. Do you know what? Her pioneering research was not even noted in their report. It wasn't until the mid-1960s that historians discovered her story and what she had done and said this woman needs to be recognized for what she contributed in the way of knowledge to medicine at her time. And there are so many other women that were practicing medicine in the 19th century. And they were Elizabeth Blackwell, Rebecca Lee Crumpler, and Susan LaFesh Picotti as one of the most consequential women practicing medicine that they have discovered to date. But it is amazing how long it takes sometimes for people to acknowledge what was known. And this is still going on today, but fortunately, we are finding that there's more and more science that is saying we need to pay attention to what would have been considered a country bumpkin in many descriptive, one of many descriptive phrases for someone that is an herbalist or has an understanding of homeopathic or naturopathic medicine. Well, you don't need to be concerned about that today because the milk that we drink today is processed industrially. And do you know that it is literally pooled with thousands of other cows to dilute any pathogens or toxins? And modern cows usually graze in cleared fields, not on the fringes of woodlands in today's world, where white snake root is most common. The last case that, or cases actually, of milk sickness in humans were two babies in St. Louis in 1963. They know how to treat it, and those babies survived. They said, you know, they've never really proved if the tremetol, and that's spelled T-R-E-M-E-T-O-L, which can be very high in levels of the snake root, but it's never been proven to be that toxic substance that creates the milk sickness. They're still working on that. But by golly, he said, you know, farmers and home farmers maybe have one or two cows. They need to be aware of this and get rid of this gnarly herb. Remember, it was from observation that she was able to say, we got to find it out. But it was an Indian woman who said, I know what plant you're looking for. Fascinating topics. We don't throw out the old ways without really coming to understand why they would work or why they wouldn't work or what was discovered. Remember, our ancestors had to go through a lot. They had to learn a lot about the environments that they lived in. And in learning about those environments, they found what worked for them and what didn't. And that was just the way it was. It is one of those things that we still are following and learning about why one thing will work for one person and for another, it can kill them. You just never know. It is all about chemistry. Chemistry is really quite fascinating. Well, I thought I would share with you, I know we're past Easter, but this is really a fun story about eggs. Yes. And on April 3rd in 1940, there was a story that was publicized in the Gazette and Daily, and it was about a woman by the name of Gertrude Smith and her mental ability to convince her chickens to lay designer eggs. Well, we see designer eggs all the time. I mean, they're all over the place. Look at what Fabergé did with his designer eggs. But we're talking about that simple egg that the chicken lays. Well, this is what happened. In 1935, she was quoted in a local paper saying, I would stand near the hen yard and visualize sunflower petals in on the eggs along with my initials. In a few days, my father came into the house all excited. He said, "Here is the sunflower egg." The pattern of a sunflower was incised into the shell on the flattened part. More eggs had images, including one with the reversed letters of her initials, showed up. And she said, when I broke one open, the design appeared raised on the inner surface of the shell. Well, guess what? Yes. A further edition of the Gazette and Daily carried testimonies by witnesses swearing to the authenticity of the decorated eggs. Well, she continued to try her skills. She'd visualize an egg with a triangular cross-section. It showed up on the egg. So she stopped trying to influence the chickens because it scared her. She said, "I don't understand why I'm able to do this." Well, stepping back in history, in 1680, there was a chicken that laid an egg bearing the image of a comet shortly after a comet passed through the night sky. I don't know of anybody that mentally projects images into chickens so that that design will appear on the egg. Gertrude Smith was a unique woman. My, my, can you imagine the conversations people had about her decorator eggs of a different type? Donna Sebo here, 253-582-5597. I realize that we're just about out of time, and I want to share just a little point of information that I learned today about Egypt. Now, I did not know about an area in Egypt called Osirian. And it's very, very old, and it's located in an area of Egypt called Abydos. It's a structure in Abydos, Osirian, and it's 350 miles south of Giza. It has a high level of sophisticated structure. Now, archaeologists have been clearing so much in the area, different areas of Egypt. They have been finding so much information about these ancient cities and structures that they had no idea existed. Well, this is very near the Temple of Seti. It is so old that they honestly do not know how old it is, as it is occurring with many of these places that they are discovering. There are these massive, massive stones. They're made of granite. The granite came from over 200 miles away, some weighing more than 100 tons, just one piece. They are precisely carved design, and granite is very hard. There's no mortar in some of the stone building formations. There's no art on it. There's no artifacts that have been left around. What they found is that this ancient site, they had to dig it out. It is 10 to or 15 feet below the ground level. It is so old. There are even watermarks on this grouping of stones. And they found that this particular one building was so complex, the sophistication of their hydraulic system was far greater than anything that we have records of in the Egyptian dynasties that we know about. There was nothing that was ever built by the Egyptians like this. So, oh my goodness, I learned so much today. It was quite fascinating. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Realize that life is an adventure, and you can find and learn so many new things. Open your mind and attitudes and realize that there's always something that can expand your world in a magical way. And I'm so delighted to be able to share this time with you. I look forward to having you join me again. Donna Sebo here. Take care. God bless. And we'll be talking again soon. Oh, and don't forget the doubleheader tomorrow. Yes, Warriors for Peace. And also, my regular show. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.